It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show,
the federal government, as part of the Affordable Care Act, has budgeted and will provide 100% of the funding in the near term for the expansion. That is to say, the difference between the number of people that are currently provided for under Virginia law that are eligible for Medicaid right now and the number of people who would potentially be eligible if they reached up to that 130%. So Virginia really stands to gain a great deal and potentially even stands to lose if we don't take advantage of that funding.
Marco Grimaldo, CEO and President of the Virginia Interfaith Center for Public Policy, discusses poverty, at-risk children, healthcare, immigration, and other issues that ought to be on the minds of our legislators as the 2013 Virginia General Assembly session starts today. And during this week's News You Can Use, we explain how to stop others from controlling your bank account through automatic debits. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 192, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Have lenders or companies automatically taken money from your account even after you've told them to stop? Has your bank allowed companies to take money even after you've told the bank the company no longer is authorized? If so, here are the steps to take. First, notify the lender or company in writing that they no longer are authorized to debit electronically from your bank account. Typed, dated, and signed letter sent by certified mail gives you a paper trail. Keep a copy of the letter and the certified mail receipt. For companies with a P.O. box only or a foreign company, email the company and save your send mail message. Second, notify your bank immediately of your withdrawal of authorization for automatic debits. Bring copies of the letters or emails you sent to the lenders and companies. You must let the bank know about the unauthorized debits, using this phrase, at least 3 business days before the next withdrawal is supposed to happen. Notify your bank in writing, as well as in person, that you have revoked authorization and that any debits after you notified the lender or company are unauthorized. Dispute all unauthorized debits after you get your bank statement. File a report with the bank if the lender continues the unauthorized debits. Third, do not do a stop payment on an automatic debit. This is costly, $25 to $35 each, and is ineffective at stopping debits by companies operating outside the law, such as internet payday lenders who will run the amount through for slightly more or less, wiping away any benefit of the stop payment. Fourth, open a new bank account at a different financial institution and move any direct deposits. Opening a new account at the same bank can result in the lender getting access to the new account and the bank charging you more fees. Fifth, close the account the offending lender or company has access to. You may be required to do this 3 days before any automatic debits occur. You must request a hard close on the account. If not, some banks will reopen a closed account, which allows them to assess fees which you later will owe. Remember to challenge any unauthorized debits until the account is completely closed. Sixth, If the bank continues to allow debits or doesn't allow you to close your account due to overdraft or insufficient fund fees due to unauthorized debits, file a complaint with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau at www.consumerfinance.gov. For more information, go to www.virginiafairloans.org. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. We're here at the Virginia Interfaith Center for Public Policy, and we're speaking with the Executive Director, Marco Grimaldo. We will be talking about issues that will be facing the 2013 Virginia General Assembly session. Welcome to the show, Marco.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
We're glad to have you here. Before we get started on the legislative issues, could you tell our listeners briefly what is the Virginia Interfaith Center for Public Policy?
I'm happy to. The center is an organization, a nonprofit advocacy organization that's been around for more than 30 years now. We have members throughout Virginia from many faith traditions who come together on common ground concerns to try and change public policy and educate the public in ways that are helpful, especially to low-income and disenfranchised communities.
Now, there are, of course, a multitude of issues that affect low-income and disenfranchised communities. The two that we hope to speak about this week are health care access and implementation and poverty and hunger alleviation. So going back to health care access and implementation, what are the big issues that are affecting, that are confronting Virginia right now in the area of health care?
Well, that's a really helpful place to start, I think, because right now Virginia is making some choices in the context of the General Assembly and the decisions of the governor to think about how we deal with health care, both in terms of how we purchase health insurance, whether that's going to be through access to the health exchanges that are proposed in the Affordable Care Act, or whether they are for low-income Virginians, access to the Medicaid program. Those are two sets of decisions that will be coming up for consideration at the coming General Assembly. We are especially weighing in on the question of Medicaid expansion. It is available to us as a consequence of the Affordable Care Act. Many people know this as Obamacare, which now makes it possible for Virginia to expand coverage to many low-income people who live below or very near the poverty line who might not otherwise have been eligible.
So why would Virginia be unwilling to do this?
Well, that's not clear why they would be unwilling. And in fact, my guess is that most Virginians would think that this is a very good idea. There are two important reasons why it's a good idea, and probably a lot more other reasons that would maybe support that argument. One of those reasons is that in fact, the federal government, as part of the Affordable Care Act, has budgeted and will provide 100% of the funding in the near term for the expansion. That is to say, the difference between the number of people that are currently provided for under Virginia law that are eligible for Medicaid right now and the number of people who would potentially be eligible if they reached up to that 130%. So Virginia really stands to gain a great deal and potentially even stands to lose if we don't take advantage of that funding. Imagine a scenario where Virginians paying federal taxes are covering the costs of other states who choose to take advantage of the Medicaid expansion, and yet Virginians themselves who are in need are not able to get that. That seems unreasonable to many Virginians. I think the other good set of reasons that makes sense for Virginia to take part in the expansion is that it really does resolve a lot of the challenges that Virginians have seen as a consequence of currently uninsured populations, that is to say, people who show up at the emergency room or who may be in need of acute care because they've put off preventive care solutions in the near term. Down the road, they often show up with much more serious dilemmas, and our solutions to those problems, those healthcare concerns, may be much more expensive to treat at the far end. So I think those are really important arguments to be made and are going to play themselves out as the legislature decides how to respond to the question of whether Virginia should expand its Medicaid eligibility.
And you said initially, of course, for the near term, the federal government will pay 100% of the cost of the Medicaid expansion. What about beyond the near term? I know there is some state share, but I gather that is still very reasonable compared to what Virginia would get back from the federal government.
That's right. I think there's sort of two parts to what Virginia would pay. And one is Virginia has responsibility to pay for the administration of the program. But then Virginia down the road would also pay a larger proportion, perhaps as much as 10% of the cost of that expanded pool of eligible persons. It would not go beyond that. My sense is that no matter how you count the cost benefit of the Medicaid expansion, the benefit strongly accrues to the state of Virginia.
And what would happen to those people that we mentioned earlier, the ones who don't get Medicaid now, even if they are very poor and have zero income because they are childless and adults, or they have children but are above 30% of poverty? What would happen to those folks if Virginia does not opt for what seems to be a very good deal in this Medicaid expansion?
Well, I think we already know what happens to them, because right now Virginia does not do much to cover a great many people who are in low-income situations or who are struggling to provide for their families. We don't provide much support for them if they earn perhaps more than $7,000 a year. They're not going to be eligible for very much under the Medicaid statute that Virginia currently has in place. So we know that they don't get access to timely care. We know that they don't get access to much preventative care. We have a great deal of concern that when they do show up to the emergency room, the acute care they receive is very expensive. And in fact, I think the other question that may be more relevant in my thinking is, what does it do to Virginia to have large numbers of people that need health care that are not getting health care, and that when they do show up to get care, it's very expensive? And I think for Virginia, it does some really bad things. It means that doctors and hospitals aren't reimbursed at very good rates. They are, in many cases, having to forego unreimbursed medical expenses that are provided to people who are uninsured and unable to receive any kind of coverage under Medicaid. I think that, in fact, Virginia as a whole will benefit if we have the ability to bring people under coverage, not just because more people are getting services, but also because when more people are covered, we have a greater capacity to control the costs. And I think that really could be a long-term win for Virginia.
And if I'm understanding you correctly, not only that hundreds of thousands of uninsured people will now have insurance, but also that the healthcare system itself will be better financed and will be able to provide better healthcare for people who even now currently have insurance. That basically it's a win-win for everybody.
I think that's right. And I want to say something about, I want to say two things about that. One is that I think it's really been interesting and very helpful that the governor has really been moving toward finding real innovative solutions to containing costs associated with healthcare. And there have been a number of proposals that, at least within the Medicaid conversations, have said, well, gosh, we could do a better job if we had the capacity to contain costs, or if we could do a nuanced structure for managed care. There are people who are smarter about this and will say it better than I do. But I think it's wonderful to think about innovative ways to contain costs and to provide better managed care. But that's all dependent on first getting people into the system, first getting them insurance, and having done so, being able to then serve them better and more effectively.
Now, we've heard a lot about the economic arguments for the Medicaid expansion. We've heard some about the policy arguments and the just basically better health care arguments. What about the moral argument? We are, after all, talking about the Virginia Interfaith Center for Public Policy. What is the moral argument, leaving aside the economics?
That's a really helpful opportunity for me to say who we are, a little bit more about who we are. So the Interfaith Center has broad representation and support from the faith community throughout Virginia. Muslims, Christians, Jews, Hindus, Sikhs, others who see their moral and spiritual life as compelling them toward a sense of justice. We sometimes disagree. In fact, oftentimes we may disagree on what gets caught up in that little category of justice. But on the whole, we're moving and pulling in the same direction. And I think that across the board, we agree that caring for people in their time of need, when they are ill and unable to care for themselves, that that is, in fact, a moral obligation for us. And that's why on the issue of Medicaid expansion, even when we disagree with others about the details, we can say together, we think people should be provided the opportunity to receive good health care, especially when they aren't able to care for themselves.
And do you find that argument persuasive when you're discussing public policy with the policymakers, particularly with the legislators?
I think so. I mean, I think it's really interesting, having been in this field for some time, when you speak with decision makers, they bring all of themselves to the table. Not only the budget-minded business leader, but also the focused political leader and the spiritual individual. And so I'd like to think that the sound argument that makes a lot of business sense, but is also brought forward from a conscientious moral perspective, brings added strength to the conversation.
Now, turning back to the economic argument and shifting to a little bit of a different issue, you mentioned the health exchange that would be available for those who actually are not covered by the Medicaid expansion that we hope Virginia will opt for. And this is going to allow folks, or in fact small businesses, to essentially shop online the way we do for plane tickets and motel reservations for health insurance. I thought we'd gone so far down the road that Virginia basically is going to be part of the federal exchange. Is that the course we're on, or can that at some point in the future be changed?
Both of those are correct. I think it is the course that we're on, but it can be changed in the future. So Virginia has previously, at least legislators in Virginia have previously expressed an interest in developing a Virginia exchange. But it's also clear that Virginia has not made the progress that it needed to in order to put that into place. And that, in fact, there may be opportunities down the road to make that more attuned to what Virginia needs or wants. So for the time being, in fact, we may well have a federally run healthcare exchange in Virginia. I think the opportunity still exists for us in Virginia to become aware of what that exchange will look like, to make sure that Virginians have every opportunity to avail themselves of that healthcare exchange once it's in place, and provide good information to one another and resources to one another as we go to that common marketplace to compare plans to make sure that we're getting the plan that makes sense for us.
One of the initiatives that the Virginia Interfaith Center for Public Policy is pushing is what you describe as moral budgeting. I've heard people say all budgets are moral documents. What do we mean by that?
I first started hearing that from a couple of my former colleagues, from my friend David Beckman, and in conversations with folks at Sojourners and wonderful folks trying to figure out, well, what does the federal budget mean? What are our responses as people of faith when we look at a budget that emphasizes one set of spending versus another? Does that say something about who we are as a people? And I think the same question bears consideration here at the state level. This is a question we have to ask ourselves. Where are we putting our attention, our focus? What kinds of things are we spending money on? And what kinds of things are we allowing to go by? As we look at the budget in Virginia, those are the kinds of questions that we ask here at the center. And as a consequence, I think what you see in the public policy recommendations that we make, if our budgets put a lot of money into these other sort of areas, into becoming a business-friendly state, who's going to speak up for low-income people? Well, that is where we find our responsibility, or where we see our path leading us. So we would argue that we need to talk about policies related to low-income families, to consumer finance protection, or to maybe thinking about what, you know, the anti-poverty programs like TANF can do for low-income struggling families.
And let's talk about those issues separately. What do you see that Virginia could do, should do, that Virginia is not doing now in terms of consumer finance protection?
Well, there's a couple of areas. One of them has to do with open-ended loans, and the other one has to do with internet lending. Let me take the one that I think is a real opportunity for us, and that is the response to internet lending. Internet loans are not legal in the state of Virginia. Virginia, in statute, has really prescribed what it would mean to offer what we think of as payday loans, and said that you must have a physical location within Virginia. That's the only way that you can seek licensure and that you can operate within the bounds of Virginia. So anyone who's operating online, perhaps from some location that we don't know of, is not allowed to offer loans of that type within Virginia. And yet we see them on the evening, late night programming. Sometimes I hear the ads for them on the radio. These are not legal loans to be offered. And in some cases, they really have cost some Virginians a great deal and created legal problems that they didn't need. These are folks that are taking advantage of many Virginians, and we need to do more. we have some opportunities there. The state of West Virginia, our neighbor, has really taken this seriously, and their attorney general has pursued companies that are offering illegal or unauthorized loans and sought a solution by getting them in court and getting them to pay back the money that they have, in many cases, not lawfully taken from people who took loans. We have now a lot more of information about who those people are, who those companies are, where they live, how to file against them, and we would like to see the Attorney General in Virginia really take some action there and take advantage of what we've learned from West Virginia and from other states that have begun to do the same thing and say, let's, at least for those companies that we know of that are offering loans illegally in Virginia, let's make sure we stop that. And I think the Attorney General can make a lot of progress in that direction.
So this sounds like really an enforcement of the law issue rather than a change of the law issue.
I think that's correct with respect to the internet lending. I think with respect to the open-ended loans and to others, there really is more that the legislature could do to close loopholes and to make sure that, in fact, we don't offer sort of these open-ended, unregulated loans that they're reasonable.
And what type of regulation would the Virginia Interfaith Center for Public Policy like to see for these open-ended loans? I mean, used to be payday loans were not regulated. Now they are, although very poorly. Right. It used to be the car title loans were not regulated. Now they are, although, again, not as well as we would like. What does the center see as the proposal for possibly regulating these open-ended loans?
I think in the past we've really argued for some caps on the overall amount of interest that might be collected on loans, also limits on the number of loans that can be offered to an individual so that a person might not take out more than one loan at a time. There are a range of proposals currently coming before the legislature, and we'll be looking at all of those, trying to think about, well, what's the right way to address this so that we aren't so limiting business that business can't be profitable, but that also we're not taking advantage of individuals who can ill afford to pay high interest rates for short-term, what should be short-term loans. If there's one last concern in that category, it is about the nature of the loan itself. In many cases, because the individual taking them out intends for them to be short-term loans, there are some aspects to the lending that really make it problematic in that it has requirements on when you notify and how soon you pay off and how you are able to pay off a loan that sometimes throw the borrower into an endless loop of continued loans that they don't intend. And we think that those are really intended to take advantage of folks that can oftentimes find it very difficult to get loans or get other kinds of support in the mainstream marketplace. So I think any kinds of regulation that would better serve the borrower or support the consumer in making good decisions about their financial future would be very welcome.
You've been listening to Marco Grimaldo, CEO and President of the Virginia Interfaith Center for Public Policy, in the first part of a two-part interview about issues before the 2013 Virginia General Assembly that started today. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show.
I'm Michelle King for the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. Here's this week's legal aid success story, a true tale where justice prevailed. Mr. Bradley, a 74-year-old disabled man, lived with his mother until her death in 2003. Following her passing, his two brothers, ages 69 and 72, moved into the house with him. Subsequently, Mr. Bradley received a condolence letter from Medi-Cal, which went on to demand more than $20,000 for health care services received by his mother. In the event they could not pay the amount, the letter noted that the state of California would put a lien on their home.
The family home was owned jointly by the two younger brothers and their late mother. Living on a fixed income, the brothers could not afford to sell the house, as rent would be too high for them. They turned to the Legal Aid Foundation of Los Angeles for help and were put in touch with paralegal Roseland Williams. Williams filed a hardship waiver on their behalf. It was subsequently approved by the state, and the brothers were allowed to keep their home. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and that's this week's Legal Aid Success Story, a true tale where justice prevailed.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. The 2013 Virginia General Assembly session started today, Wednesday, January 9. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 when we continue our conversation with Marco Grimaldo, CEO and President of the Virginia Interfaith Center for Public Policy, about poverty, at-risk children, health care, immigration, and other issues that ought to be on the minds of our legislators. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.